I promise not to be overly enthusiastic, although I'm very excited about this topic because I know some of you may not be morning people like me. Okay, let's get started. Biomedical agriculture. I really want to thank the program committee for inviting me to give this presentation. This is a journey that I want to share with you that has been ongoing at Colorado State University for the past 5 years. But where did the journey really start? By the way, this is cooperation. You're going to try to follow my red pointer so that you can see the white pointer on both screens. So you should be able to see this either side that I point to. So I remember in graduate school, very little discussion about value-added agriculture. When I went to the University of New Hampshire in the 80s, I remember a lot of discussion about adding value. I took a hiatus. I was at a small cancer research center for 15 years, and when I came back to a college of agriculture, there was a lot of discussion of adding value. And I asked the people that I was interacting with, plant breeders, I said, how do you decide what gets to the supermarket? Because you are making that decision. And I heard a lot of important traits that are in the process of getting crops to the marketplace. But one of the things they said to me is, health isn't one of those things because we've never had the opportunity to work with someone in biomedical sciences to know how to select for health. And biomedical agriculture, the story I'm going to tell today, is the journey that began with that discussion. I always have to have a mission, a reason to present. So today, my mission is over here. Chance favors the prepared mind. And I hope that by what I share of our experiences, that if chance opportunities present themselves to you, that you will find what I have to say as helpful to you in taking advantage of those opportunities. So let the voyage begin. We didn't know what to call this program where we were going to unite disciplines in the plant sciences with the biomedical community. And when we first started, we called it Crops for Health. At that point in time, our university was going through a discovery process. And we were reading the works of Jim Collins, an economist from Stanford. And he urges when you're building things to think about it as a clock. And so what we decided is we were going to build a clock that was called Crops for Health, and have strategies, develop strategies as time went on about how best to do that. And we soon discovered that if we were going to train people and do research, that the term Crops for Health didn't capture what we were trying to do, and that we really needed to have some way to articulate our mission. And so we decided to call this a transdisciplinary research effort in biomedical agriculture. And if you go home and Google biomedical agriculture, I suspect that there will take you to one place, and that's, at the moment, Colorado State. And my hope is that in a year from now, it'll take you to many of your institutions because you've become interested in this, what we dub, a new field. The vision. If you're going to do something big, like Crops for Health or biomedical agriculture, we're challenged to have what Jim Collins refers to as big, hairy, audacious goals. So we said, let's articulate such a vision. And that vision is to provide the consumer with crop varieties in the marketplace around the world for which we will have evidence of enhanced health benefits. That's our vision. That's what we're trying to do. Where does Crops for Health come from? It comes from what I am referring to as a plant food health conundrum. What do we mean by that? Well, if you look up here in the left-hand corner, the perception is plant foods are good for you. If you look at the world's data, the population data, there isn't support for that right now. There's a problem. There's a gap here. I just returned from a conference in Washington. The World Cancer Research Foundation and the American Institute for Cancer Research, 5 years in the making, released a report last week. I happened to present it at that meeting. Get this. The conclusion, the recommendation to the world, is to consume diets mostly of plant origin. for cancer prevention, and I will suggest to you a way to think about not just cancer prevention, but for chronic disease prevention. Yet, when you dig into that report, there is no convincing evidence that currently exists that suggests that any vegetable, fruit, or grain has a significant effect in reducing the risk for cancer in global populations. That's a conundrum. Where's that coming from? We've thought a lot about that. And I don't like word slides, but please forbear. Why could this be? Plant foods don't have any effect on the development of chronic diseases. That could be. And it could be that people who eat plant food diets have other lifestyle behaviors that are associated with chronic disease risk prevention. The way humankind eats plant foods doesn't have any effect on the development of chronic diseases. A second possibility. Or maybe it's the way that scientists measure plant food intake is insufficient to detect health benefits. Crops for Health is a response to these possibilities where we hypothesize it's a combination of option 2 and 3. And so Crops for Health is intended, was developed with two questions in mind. Varieties within a food crop differ markedly in protective activity. Hypothesis 1. Hypothesis 2. Human eating patterns lack sufficient botanical diversity to promote health and prevent disease. How botanically diverse is your diet today? How many different botanical families do you eat from? Do we train our students, our family members, to think about botanical diversity? That's what you guys deal with all the time. Let's bring agriculture and make it center stage in the biomedical research field. Another and the last word slide. So a group of faculty thinking about this last year got together and said, and I'll go through it briefly, we're going to have this program meaningfully reduce chronic diseases, and these are the ones, around the world. And to do that, we're going to develop food crop varieties that show maximum human health benefit. And we're going to understand how they work so we can get policy changes. And we're going to develop tools to disseminate these findings around the world. Because if we, as a community, develop new crop varieties, and we don't have them offered in the global marketplace, we have done little good. So it's a three-part program. Now, a couple of minutes ago, I said it's interdisciplinary. What do I mean by that? I think a picture's worth 1,000 words. So here's Crops for Health. Who has to be a player in this for it to be successful? And the answer is all of us. We have to get the plant scientist and the biomedical scientist to leap into the circle. Transdisciplinary means that you bring your training with you, but you're willing to be called something different. The example, we put the Cancer Prevention Laboratory in the Department of Horticulture and Landscape Architecture, and we are the mediators between people in the plant sciences and the biomedical sciences to get folks to step out of their comfort zone into the circle. I was talking to NPR about our program, and I said, we're getting the farmers involved. And he said, why are you doing that? And I said, because if they're not involved at the beginning, when we ask them to plant seed that they're not familiar with, and it's their livelihoods on the line, if they haven't been part of that decision-making process, they're not going to want to do it. So this Crops for Health program seeks to get all players, anybody who deals with food in any way, shape, or form, involved and contributing in the center of the circle. And that's what transdisciplinary means. A willingness for me to say, I'm trained in biomedical sciences, but I'm becoming a plant scientist, and it's fun. And to get plant scientists to say, I never thought I could do biomedical research, but I can. That's what we're about. Now you say to yourself, well, you're in a cancer prevention lab. How do you get to chronic diseases? And a few years ago, we wouldn't have been able to put this slide up on the screen. 4 chronic diseases, obesity, cancer, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease. They are the problems, chronic disease problems of the world. And if you want to call aging, and as the older I get, I think it is a disease, and aging a disease, you could put it here as well. Now, we know each of those diseases by its handle, but the reality of it is, as you understand metabolic processes, all four diseases have something in common. And it's not hard to follow this because we all go to the physician and they all do the same test on us that we use to understand altered glucose utilization. That's what we normally think about as problems for the diabetic. So fasting blood glucose, you probably had that. Insulin-like growth factors, we measure those in fasting blood. You take that plus inflammation. When this is altered, cells that are designed to, you know, combat infections, etc., they become mobilized, but they generate, in trying to protect us, chemicals to cause cellular damage. These three metabolic processes are altered in all four diseases. So if we do something here, we can anticipate that it's going to have effects on all four chronic diseases. Added to that, the newest dimension is that if you look at those four diseases and the pathogenesis, the problems that occur during diseases, they are due to alterations in cell proliferation. You all study apoptotic cell death. It happens in people, happens in plants, and blood vessel formation. The metabolic syndrome here and these diseases are linked by alterations in cell proliferation, apoptosis, and angiogenesis. I'm going to show you an example of how this all comes together in just a minute. Created equal. That is the first question that we've asked. We picked apple because apple a day keeps the doctor away. It doesn't matter what kind of apple that you eat. And we also focused on bean and potato and more. Why would we think that varieties within a crop might differ in their health promotional activity? A collage. We think it's associated with plant secondary metabolites, otherwise known as bioactive food components. There are 14 classes of bioactive food components. Think about it. Why are they present in the plant? They protect the plant against pests, microbes, other plants, and people. How did they get there? They evolved over time. Different parts of the world, different ages of the world's development. Consequently, we can understand evolutionary origin of plants and know from a chemical perspective that they emerged at different times and they emerged with an emphasis of the different classes of the 14 chemicals. Michael Wink over in Heidelberg has diagrammed some of that in these dendrograms. Different families of plants use different chemicals, and members within families use different chemicals to protect themselves. So, when we look around the world, what varies among populations? The varieties of plants, the crops that they have access to. It's like it would be surprising if they didn't vary a whole bunch. Yet, I asked my nutrition colleagues, does it matter what variety of a crop that you eat for health? And the answer is no. And if I'd asked many of you, you'd probably say the same thing. So we decided to go in and challenge the obvious answer. Hence, we started working through chance. I had the opportunity, continue to have the opportunity to work with Mark Brick, a plant breeder, a dry bean breeder, a field breeder. And we asked these questions. Do dry beans have an effect on experimentally induced breast cancer? Something I know a lot about. Mark knows a lot about dry beans. But neither one of us knows about the other's area. So we were willing to leave comfort zones and work together. And are there differences among dry bean types? I didn't know what to call them when I started, in cancer inhibitory activity. How do you do this? Well, we decided to, first I learned you had to get identity preserved seed. That's what they call it in the bean world. And big decision, we're going to work with material the way people eat it. So that was cooked canned beans. And then we just simply figured a way, we freeze dried to alter it minimally, milled it, and put it into experimental diets. And here's the experimental diets that we feed to the animals. This is a listing of the components in a purified diet. And we chose concentrations of bean from 7.5% weight by weight to 60% in the diet. Humans in the United States, we all consume right around this level, zero, a tablespoon a day of dry beans. This is Phaseolus vulgaris. The recommendation is about 3/4 cups a day. A lot of the world consumes 1.5 cups a day, some 3 cups a day, and the animals will tolerate up to 6 cups a day. We learned, as part of this, the first important thing to do is do a dose response. We got smart over the past couple years about how to go about this work. We decided to study something we understood, preclinical model for breast cancer. It's in the rat. Breast cancer in people takes 15 to 20 years to develop. If you want to think about and understand what cancer looks like, that's a cancer growing in a sea of normality. This is the rat breast. The human breast looks very similar. In all stages of disease development, early stages we call premalignant, as well as the cancer, which is a malignancy. Each of us has cancer cells developing, potential cancer cells developing in our body every day. We can't avoid that. So our experimental protocol is we set risk in these animals by giving a chemical, and then we begin our intervention after that risk is set, much like it occurs in us every day, but before there's any evidence of malignant change. And we study the effects, in this case of dry bean, on the development of cancer. On the y-axis is our two endpoint indicators of cancer occurrence, cancer multiplicity and tumor burden. And as you can see here, it was a highly significant effect of dry bean, dose-dependent, on the occurrence of cancer. Now we said, if that cartoon I showed you a couple minutes ago about chronic diseases is right, wouldn't you expect these particular factors be affected by bean? So we looked in the plasma of the animals, and we saw that fasting glucose was dose-dependently decreased, insulin was dose-dependently decreased, IGF-1, that's very important for tumor growth, was decreased, and markers of inflammation, a cytokine that we measure in people as well as the animals as a measure of inflammation, and C-reactive protein. So that cartoon I showed you a minute ago that links the diseases, we're seeing evidence that cancer as well as markers of diabetes and heart disease are impacted by dry bean consumption. So a big pile of beans, the way I first was introduced to it. I later learned that these are dry bean market classes that are important and commercially important. And the question is, are they created equal? And the answer, looking at incidence of cancer, or the average number of cancers per animal. You can see that green is the control group. Marked variation among the market classes in cancer inhibitory activity. Well, when Dr. Brick saw this, he said, Henry, it's time for your next genetics lesson. I said, I'm a welcome player. Sit me down and teach me. And he showed me this. He said, dry bean market classes, although you didn't know it, so I wasn't biased, can be divided into two centers of origin or domestication, Andean and Middle American. And he says, look at your data. He said, you got to do it again because people will question it. So we did it with dry bean from a second year, did the cancer studies 12 months apart. We combined the data. And what we found is that kidney beans, white and red, which are Andean market classes, center of domestication, seem to have more anti-cancer activity than those from Middle America. So not only did we have variation among varieties, but it's been explained to me that Andean and Middle American are genetically distinct, even though we just think about them as dry beans. And the story gets more interesting. So statistically, beans from the two centers of domestication are different. The study effects, you wonder about environmental factors. The study effects were not different. We saw differences by race. We can see that here. With the Nuevo Grande being more protective than Mesoamerican. And the story goes on. So what we learned is it's important to pick extrema. So the extremes were navy bean and white kidney, which you see in the left panel, which are not surprisingly statistically different. But color, a lot of people say, it's the pigments that are protective. no effect of sea coat pigment color, suggesting that this is not explained by antioxidant activity. Everybody, when they saw that data at home, said, well, what's the chemical? What's the chemical? And we think that's the wrong question. Rather, let's drill down. Let's understand this as a team. Carcinogenesis is a failure of tissue size homeostasis. And what's that mean? Another cartoon. This is a cartoon of the cells, a single layer of cells that line ductal epithelium in the body. They're fed by a blood vessel. Yes, Henry got his colors a little bit mixed up. Yeah, that probably would have been better as green. Yeah, we know that. And in here, in this arrow, every day you have some of these cells that develop a potential to become cancerous. If that potential is manifest by abnormal proliferation, failure to die, you get a tumor mass. And when a tumor mass gets big enough, it needs new blood vessels, and that's called angiogenesis. So let's first find out how dry beans affect tissue size homeostasis. I thought I'd just show these. This is how we measure cell proliferation and apoptosis in the animal. Some of you probably do it in plant material. This is cell proliferation in the right-hand panel in a normal breast duck. This is the brown labeled cells are the cells that are proliferating in a mammary carcinoma. Obviously, there's a bunch more proliferating cells. This is a duct in the breast where there's no apoptotic cell death. This is tumor where apoptosis is occurring, but it's not occurring enough to prevent the tumor from forming. So we said, well, how does dry beans from the Andean or Middle American center of domestication affect the level of cell proliferation in tumors? And the answer is not very much. Tumor cells proliferate about once every 24 hours. But tumor cells can die at a rate of every 3 hours. And what we saw is a statistically significant dose-dependent induction of apoptotic cell death, which is both statistically significant and clinically relevant. And interestingly, it was highest in beans of Andean center of domestication. So we said, well, let's do that comparison thing again with the circulating analytes and looking at glucose, by center of domestication, Andean being the greatest reduction. See the same effects on insulin, IGF-1, IL-6, and C-reactive protein. What's going on here? So we said, how do you connect these pieces? How are we doing? What's the strategy? And we're beginning to put our pharmacologist's hat on. So we say, well, okay, we know we have effects on IGF-1 and insulin. And this very light shaded thing is a cell. And I could make this real complicated. I said, you guys don't need complicated. You just need to know how we're driving through the cell to understand. We know on the other side of the cell that we've had effects, no effect on proliferation, but an effect on apoptosis. How can we connect this side to this side? We need a receptor, a kinase, and a target. And we said, we suspect that dry beans affecting phospho-AKT, otherwise known as protein kinase B, probably have it in the plant world. And so I'll show you the data from that. Why that's so helpful is that pharmaceutical companies are developing target chemicals that target the steps in this pathway. In doing structure-activity relationships, we can use the pharmaceutical industry as a helper to understand the natural products that are present in dry bean that could be impacting this metabolic cascade. And here's the data. Here's a Western blot looking at phospho-AKT or protein kinase B. And as we predicted, we see reductions of the activated form of AKT with Middle American and Andean, and the effects are greater in Andean. Well, you know, Henry, we're plant people. What about the plants? So we put on our hats, worked with Mark, and said, in the clinic, we're using genomics, metabolomics, and proteomics to understand meaningful differences. what's different about white kidney beans and navy beans? So at the level of gene expression, Dr. Brick grew several types of specific varieties. And I think we have a fire drill.
That's interesting. We'll find out what that means.
Sure.
Attention. Attention. An emergency has been reported.
I guess not.
Well, that was kind of a refreshing break. So, I'll have to write a little note. What, you know, that's cool. I've not had that happen before. So, we were in the fields, and we were planting different varieties of navy bean and white kidney. And I do clinical work, and I take RNA from people, and I array it on Affymetrix chips. And so our first thing was, well, you know, there's not a commercially available Physiolus chip. Let's try the Affy soy chip, and that didn't work so well. So if you're interested in Physiolus, I can tell you that Affy chips didn't work so well, at least in our hands. But one of our colleagues, Jan Leach, got in touch with Dr. Votkin's group at University of Illinois, and they had soy chips that we got a hold of. And just to show you the principal components analysis of the expression data from some of our initial work suggests that there are very distinct differences in transcript levels in navy bean versus white kidney. And we have a cool experiment ongoing to understand that more. I have a postdoc in the laboratory that loves to do 2D gels. And so from the beans that were being grown in the field, and this shows you the navy bean varieties and the white kidney varieties, we asked the question, do the protein expression patterns differ? And principal components analysis. He's so excited about this, he said, I want you to show him four different views of the principal components analysis, showing that navy bean and white kidney are in fact distinctly different, which is not surprising when you see the array data. And we're beginning to understand differences among the varieties, as we show pictured up top. And I'm most excited about the metabolomics data. We took the same beans that we fed to the rats, we did ethanol extracts, and did ultra-high pressure liquid chromatography with detection, QTOF detection, using a water system. And you can see significant differences, particularly in this area of the chromatogram, between navy bean and white kidney, with the methanol blank there. Using the proprietary water software, there are over 1,000 features that distinguish navy and white kidney in that ethanolic extract. We talked to folks at Agilent who do this for a living, and they said use Blythe-Dwyer technique and get more precision in your fractionation. We've done that, and just this one fractionation, the acidic methanol, has over 200 features that are different, and you can see how different they are by principal components analysis. And how are we going to use this data? Preliminary. We're into profiles, not one chemical. So taking the 14 classes of phytochemicals that we mentioned earlier ago, look at the relative distribution of those metabolites in navy versus white kidney, where we have a phenotype, less protective, more protective, and try to understand first metabolomically and then genomically and proteomically the features that distinguish and matter relative to health benefit. So we think it's time to look at global biodiversity, not genetic engineering. Get you to think about things a different way. We want a mutant form, in this case of dry bean, that has no anti-cancer activity, and a mutant form that has huge amounts of anti-cancer activity so we can can be patient.
Attention, attention. An emergency has been reported in this building.
Good. So secondly, to
attention
do this.
Attention all personnel.
You don't hear that now. Don't panic.
All clear.
Okay. So the lesson learned is we need extrema to mine our understanding of the phenotype to give the plant breeder the traits that are necessary. I'm going to talk real quick here. So, omics profiles, how are we going to use those? To define what health benefit really means. And then, immediately, because a lot of people would worry about, what are you going to do with this variety data? It could really hurt a lot of farmers, a lot of commodity groups. No, we're going to first advise about crop variety cocktails while we figure out the information to give the plant breeders so that they can use improvement processes to bring up the level of the water in the harbor so that all boats will float. But the story doesn't stop there. I have a graduate student. She saw this data and she said, how does all this fit with what goes on in the world? So epidemiology becomes involved. Over in the bottom right-hand panel, we have where intake is in the United States and Canada versus other parts of the world. So first of all, is there opportunity if dry bean consumption is important? And the answer, wow, yeah. But when we go to the data, we find it is miserable and it's extremely difficult to figure out what people are eating in different parts of the world because nobody has known that phaseolus consumption could be important for health benefit. The idea would be to take good data on consumption and marry it with the disease heat maps, whether it be of the states or of the world, as shown here. A difficult situation at best to try to make any sense of it. And so we don't suggest that there's a relationship right now. We wanted to illustrate for you folks the nature of the steps the basic work in the field can generate. The one thing that might be relatable, however, for us is to note
Attention, please. There is no emergency in the building. Please resume all normal activity. Thank you.
In the States.
All is clear.
Are you sure? So I thought it was just interesting to note good data that we do have from the States, where we would suspect that Hispanic women eat more dry bean, is that breast cancer rates, for example, are about half of what they are in the African American or non-Hispanic white population. So are beans an anomaly? Don't think so. I think this is gonna apply for every crop. So we did do the apple study, and as you can see from data that's been submitted for publication, there are differences, and these are statistically significant differences among apple cultivars. Well, if your favorite thing is not apples, but for America, their favorite vegetable, as you well know, is potato. We've done preliminary work on potato cultivars, not genetically diverse enough, but we're seeing between the extrema, a 34% difference. We eat a lot of potatoes. That could be kind of important. And as we back at CSU have been talking, this is the magic, this is the fun. People are saying, we'd like to become involved. So folks in the wheat community, in the rice community, have volunteered, gotten involved. We completed and are evaluating our initial dose response studies. Know what doses to study. We're trying to involve the international community, part of our clock building. And that has paid big dividends. And I thank Jan Leach and her colleagues at Erie for this slide. When they heard what we were doing, these are cultivars, 21 cultivars that have been sequenced. that they believe represent the global diversity of rice germplasm, and we're going to do the health phenotypes like we've done in dry bean, but on rice as a model organism, as a model crop. So we're very excited about our continuing work in bean and other crops, and particularly this work that really is a collaboration with the international community. Now, I'm going to take it a couple more steps quickly. To do this kind of work and understanding the discovery process, we were urged to define our competitive edge. What makes us different? And in doing that, it was a way to discover why we really were focusing where we were. And trained partly as a pharmacologist, I recognized the value of picking foods that are eaten in large amounts on a daily basis. And you know the broccoli story and President Bush, yeah. You know, not everybody likes broccoli or berries or staple food crops around the world. We eat them every day in large amounts. And yet, we have done very little to understand their health benefits. So that's our niche. Secondly, as I've talked with folks in the commodity groups and the growers, and say, what are your concerns? It occurred to us that we really need to sit back and listen and develop a profile, a concern profile of a person's crop and what we can do to create a niche that will provide health benefit. And so when I've talked to potato people, wheat people, rice people, they say low glycemic because the consumer wants things that's low glycemic, even if it turns out it doesn't really matter. Finally, another important thing for us is we want this to be a global impact program. Recognize that health concerns are conditional. They differ by different regions of the world. And so cultivars that may be appropriate for the States may be inappropriate for regions of Africa or China or Asia. So that kind of awareness, so that we are developing varieties, but with a global awareness that health concerns are conditional. Delivery systems. We don't want to keep the tools in the toolbox. We need to go beyond that. So if we can't do it in Fort Collins, Colorado, well, what makes us believe we can do it in the world? So part of this program is that we've developed a Colorado Cuisine for Life. It's a disease prevention module so that we're working in the field and that we know from a plant breeding point of view where this development's going to go. What's that look like? Well, it's something that we can get everybody involved in. You can do it at home, you can be at the supermarket, you can go to the quick serves, wherever. The disease prevention modular diet works. And it's not going to be based on the food guide pyramid. Wouldn't it be cool to actually base it on evolutionary diversity and say, we need botanical diversity to define complementary chemicals that we will determine by metabolic profiling to be providing maximal health benefit. That is our goal, to use metabolomic data to understand how you complement crops in a new way, the 21st century agricultural way. Is this myth? I do clinical work. I work with breast cancer survivors. We've had over 600 women in diet studies where we have fashioned diets that on a daily basis, the women consume 17 botanical families versus 5 botanical families. Guess what? Our data suggests that 17 botanical families has a lot better health impact than 5. It is doable. This is what the modular disease prevention diet looks like. We can go from a range of calorie intake, so if you're on a diet, 1,200 calories a day, we'd never recommend you go under that. You don't need to. All the way up to 2,800 calories per day. And we define it for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and you're supposed to have snacks. So it's a diet that will fit all the lifestyles, and it's macronutrient defined. Into the future, it will be botanical diversity defined, and it will be cultivar, and that perhaps will be a medley of cultivars defined. It gives us a way to take all the work that we'll do together and package it so that the consumer can use it. It's not a diet, it's a cuisine. People don't want to be told what to eat to be healthy. They want to enjoy what they eat and be healthy. It turns out that this little blending of circles is a real challenge. How to get people in the cultural areas to work with people in the culinary areas to work with the health professionals in nutrition and dietetics. And we're working on that one. So in summary, bring it back to Crops for Health. A transdisciplinary program in biomedical agriculture calls people to leave their disciplines behind and experiencing something new. It's about foods, not about supplements. It's a bioactive food components, not nutrients. Although nutrients are bioactive food components are important, and their importance varies with the region of the world that we're thinking about. It's about prevention rather than just treatment. Tremendous opportunities in prevention. And it's about the chronic diseases. So, folks that have heard what we're doing say, yeah, we've tried to do that before and it didn't work. So I'm sharing a secret. This is the trade secret slide. It's called innovation capture. It's when the light bulb goes on. You have to be prepared. Remember, chance favors the prepared mind. You have to be prepared to scoop it up and put it someplace, and we call that someplace Crops for Health. And this cannot be legislated top-down thing. We think that the key is you integrate folks in the workplace around the coffee pot or the teapot or the soda machine or whatever it happens to be, because the great science, in our judgment, happens from informal conversation among colleagues. It's not planned. That is what's different. It's different that a cancer prevention laboratory that does clinical work and preclinical work exists in the Department of Horticulture and Landscape Architecture and is close to the Department of Soil and Crop Sciences. That makes a difference. So I hope that you've heard things that will prompt you to be curious about Crops for Health and to help be part of the process, whether it be at your own institution or with us at Colorado State and the global community that we will try to assemble to lead the effort to put agriculture as the center peg in 21st century biomedical research. And with that, I want to acknowledge a growing number of Crops for Health Discovery Team members, a growing number of faculty, and a growing number of students and staff members. And with that, thank you very much.
Very nice. We will have some time for some questions. There are two mics. I think the lights will come up pretty soon that you in the aisles. But as you assemble there, I wanted just to take a minute to give a plaque to Dr. Thompson, and just let me read it. It says, "This plaque is for showing great courage in the face of an unbelievable series of disruptions." No. I was teasing you. It relates to being part of the Klepper lecture, and again, we are very honored to have Henry here. So, thank you very much. Bring it back.
I love questions. That's usually the most fun. So, fire away.
I'll let Anne Marie go first. Oh no, you first. Oh no.
Don't be too polite.
Okay. I'm Ray Wild, the University of Maryland, and I was Anne Marie's TA a few years ago when she took soils. I'm a soil scientist, and I find all this information about plant genetics to be fascinating. But I have a soils question. Have you studied, do you know, of any analogous effects on the health benefits of a particular cultivar when grown under different environments, for instance, different soil, nutrition, sunlight, and that type of thing? Thanks.
You bet. That's a great question, and it's a question that is always asked. And the answer is, we're hoping to find a profile, not a couple chemicals, but a profile that is robust against those kind of year-to-year variations. So we were encouraged with the dry bean work, as an example, to take dry beans that were grown in many locations over two different growing seasons and to get essentially identical levels of protection. So I'm sure there are chemicals that vary, as you said, by soil conditions and the environment, but we're hoping that there are also chemicals that are sufficiently stable in their production, or a combination, the environment doesn't matter.
Could I just ask quick follow-on. What I meant was, have you considered or do you think it might be useful as a strategy, a positive strategy, not something to be avoided, but a positive strategy in addition to plant genetics, to look for micronutrients, organic matter levels, growing seasons, things like that, types of production that might be used to do the same kinds of goals as a complementary activity?
Absolutely. Whatever light bulbs turn on in people's minds, innovation is squenched when people think they know the answers. And so the most important thing is folks have credible ideas, find a way that we can say, well, let's find out and do it. Then we know. Yes?
I am with the USDA Cooperative State Research Education and Extension Service.
Yes.
And part of our role is to try and help find opportunities for our partners who are researchers, extensionists, educationists. And in that role, I went out to NIH a couple years ago to talk to them about whether they'd be interested in working with plant breeding to look at variation in health effects. And not very many people had time to talk to me. Mm-hmm. And those that did all said either we don't have enough evidence or we have no evidence that diet affects health. And therefore, it's inappropriate for us to be working with you, which was very disappointing. And that does not seem to have inhibited the group at Colorado. And I'm wondering if maybe groups like yours can produce enough data to encourage NIH to come on board, or maybe they already in the last few years have become more attentive to this. What's been your experience? What do you think is the outlook?
That's a great question. I think attitudes are changing. So I mentioned earlier that I was just in Washington for the launch of that report that I mentioned early. And at that meeting, Dr. Peter Greenwald, who is the head of cancer prevention research at NIH, spoke. It was wonderful because he talked about the importance of looking at whether or not crop varieties may vary in their health benefit. And I thought, where'd that come from? And then John Milner, who is the head of nutrition research group, also at the National Cancer Institute, had similar kinds of comments. So I believe times are changing. The opportunities exist. The belief and understanding that metabolic processes underlie the four chronic diseases is developing a cadre of individuals to see the opportunity to take advantage of what we can now do in science. So I think the climate's changed, and I do believe a small group. I'm a believer that one person can change the world. I still haven't given that up. And that so when you put a bunch of people like those at Colorado State together and they're doing this cool thing, it's called biomedical agriculture, I think we can turn a lot of heads, and then if we get other people like you folks involved, we can turn more heads, and there will be attention. I believe agriculture needs to be the center of biomedical research in the prevention context. There's a lot of reasons to think that, and not to have agriculture excluded. It should not be. And we got to keep making that case. Yes.
Thanks for the talk. Brian Duggan, Oregon State University. Just to play devil's advocate for the moment, it's great to say this is how we should alter our diet, and the example of the kidney beans is very interesting, but often it's the people who need to change their diet most and would benefit most from this change are the ones that have the particularly unhealthy diets. Mm-hmm. The example, say, if you had a particularly healthy potato variety, but the person who eats fries all the time as their only source of potatoes, mm-hmm. That might not be the healthiest variety. How do you get those people to change their diet? It's a bit like the people in the gym are the people in society who are least needy of going to a gym. It's the people who never go to the gym that actually need to go there. Mm-hmm. How do you get the people who don't have a healthy diet to adopt such a healthy diet?
It's a great question, and actually, because we're in the clinic and community, one approach, and it's not without its political difficulties, but as has been done with tobacco, the use of tobacco products, what people tend to pay attention to a lot, whether it be all of us or I've seen work done with physicians, monetary incentives and disincentives. There is discussion about point of purchase modification of behavior, so that if people are buying that junk food, that in fact they pay a penalty for it. There's discussions about through health insurance carriers making differential rate structures, politically very thorny. But money motivates, and we just see a lot of examples of that. We have to get more clever in helping people have good reasons to adopt more appropriate behaviors. If we go through that pain, then I would suggest we should have the very best foods available that as they're consumed, they will accentuate the health benefits. That's why it's a transdisciplinary package. And that third aim in our program is to develop global dissemination tools, because we recognize the point you make is an extremely important point.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Cristobal Wawi. I work at UC Davis in wheat genetics. And my question was, do you plan to get to the molecular basis or at least to the chromosomal regions to do breeding? Or how do you plan to deploy it when at the same time we're trying to deploy disease resistance, higher end-use quality, all of those things at the same time? And do you think the market will change? Because for our producers, they want yield, disease resistance. So how do you combine that if you don't get to the molecular basis of those traits?
So for me, the answer is that, so we all know I'm a biomedical scientist learning about plants, that we find the colleagues, in this case in the wheat community, to have the right answers to those questions or ideas about how to approach. No one little group or discipline can take advantage of the opportunities. So the most important thing for me to say is, I don't have a good answer to your question, but I would go to my colleagues and understand the importance of adapted varieties going in and knowing that a lot of hard work's been done for a long time to get us to where we are, and we don't want to lose that. But how do we take it to the next level and add health benefit to the mix so that people will actually grow the seed that you give them in the field? So I don't have an answer, but I can tell you the answer is teamwork. Okay.
Vernon Cardwell, University of Minnesota. I found it very interesting that you started off talking about staple crops. And yet, when we look at a lot of what we find in the literature, the benefits of health are associated with adding diversity, which you spoke very eloquently to, and we usually think in terms of the horticultural crops, the fruits and vegetables of providing the nutrients, minerals, and phytomaterials that are beneficial. But it's the staples that feed the bulk of the world's people. And one of the issues that I wanted to, or didn't hear you speak about, is how do we increase the diversity in our diets so that other members of the plant families come into the food system when there is so little research on minor crops that represent these other plant families? Mm-hmm. Do you have evidence in the other grains, the amaranths, the kiona, and other species that could enhance this diversity in our diets?
So it's a wonderful question. You've just defined a couple lifetimes probably of work. If you go back to the kind of thinking I presented on the development of chemical diversity, I think you could make a passionate argument that it should exist and start to look at it. Yet, if it's not appreciated that the staples vary and they are eaten in large amounts daily, let's focus there, because the other work could be very important. But it seems to me, relative to the global food supply, that the work on the well-consumed staples is critical, because it could have a huge impact. So we want to just provide more and more data that this is important, and I think you'll find people will, because of their interests, pursue different things, get lots of folks involved. And you need the cash flow from NIH as well as USDA to make this happen. So keep pushing that, agriculture needs to be central in biomedical research, because it takes considerable money to do this kind of work.
Yes.
Yeah, Janice Tease, Cornell University. This is a rather thorny question, but as I look at your centers of diversity for the various crops that you're looking at, the issue of sovereignty comes up here for me. These represent national resources for many of these countries. Now you're moving into product development kind of activity. If you can comment on patenting, what you intend to see out of this, and you know whether or not we're looking forward to more social movements around biopiracy as you move from this kind of information out into the marketplace. I know that Erie has a principle of open access, and I'm wondering if you're intending the same.
My only interest, I keep saying I have 20 more years to do this kind of work, and my final 20 years I care about discovery that has human health impact, period. There are a lot of people who have the entrepreneurial ideas. I attended a talk by Paul Cox, who directs the U.S. Botanic Garden out in Hawaii, and he's an ethnobotanist and spoke eloquently about the issues that you raise. I think we have to be very sensitive and get experts involved who have done this well to protect the intellectual rights of those who we may tap to improve human health kind, yet not let that get in the way of properly making progress in this area. That may be a little pie in the sky, but I think it's, again, getting a group of people who are sensitive to these issues together so that, in fact, all the players and all the viewpoints are represented. And then you try to do the right thing and do it well. I guess we'll bounce over here. Yeah.
Okay. Stephen Guy, University of Idaho. There's already quite a few foods marketed for their perceived health benefits as organic foods. Any scientific reality that you could bring to bear on that perception that versus conventionally produced foods?
So it's conventional versus?
Any known health benefits that you can tell us about from a research standpoint that has been documented on those perceived benefits?
Sure. Since 2000, taking these plant food diets into the clinic, I've watched the literature closely because I've been on a weekly basis at times working with people that we're intervening with, and they're watching the literature and what's reported. And it's been alarming that colleagues from around the world have been showing lack of specific evidence about particular crops. And it has caused us to say, why is that? And that is best documented in the report that was released last week. And David Klorfeld, who runs the intramural program at USDA, he commented, we all know that plant foods provide health benefits. We're having trouble figuring out why we haven't been able to document that. So I guess the simple answer to your question is, if you look at the world's literature, and as good scientists, we'd have to say at present time, there's nothing that's considered convincing. And everybody believes the plant foods are good for you.
Just one more question and then invite them down to the front.
Okay. Last question and then you can come on down to the front if you want to do any more talking. I'm sorry, your mic's... Talk real loud? Okay.
I'm Joe Dixon from Texas A&M University, and I'm working on binders for aflatoxin, which occurs on grains. When I saw your seeds, I immediately wondered, are you considering the indirect effects such as mycotoxins are associated with certain seeds, such as beans, since they do contribute to causing liver cancer, for example, in the case of aflatoxin? Mm-hmm.
So that's a great question. I can tell you that the report that I've mentioned a couple times now, of the all the data that was presented, what is considered convincing is the link between aflatoxin, hepatitis, and liver cancer. So that has to be properly controlled and watched for. There's a lot of different reasons around the world that the mycotoxins, aflatoxin in particular, is consumed, and efforts have to be directed to try to reduce that, not at the expense of ignoring crops simply because of that problem. And folks at Hopkins are very much working on that, particularly in Africa and Asia.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's thank Dr. Thompson one more time.